Okay, let's start this year. Okay, if anybody wants to show their faces, be happy to see all of you. Just full disclosure, this is the shiur that I'm giving on Shabbat at the Laskov Minyan. So if you plan on being there, you can sign off right now. Although this one, you'll at least get the multimedia presentation. Let me share my screen so you can see what I am showing you. Here we go. Okay, very good. Can everybody see my screen? I can't hear you. Let me see if I can.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, good, good, good.
Yes.
Let me see this. Get rid of that. Oh, there you guys are. Now I can see. Okay, great. All right, we're continuing since Bereshit. Actually, I've been doing this theme of a minor character in a major story, talking about seemingly minor characters in the Torah. We started, let's see if I can remember, Lemech, then we did Terach last week. What did we do last week? Lech Lecha. We did, who remembers? It wasn't Shul. I can't remember now. Let me see. Hold on one second. It's uploaded. Oh, no, it's not on my Torah. So you know what? Let me just take a look just so I can remember.
Malki Tzedek.
There we go. Malki Tzedek. Thank you, Gina. Excellent. Thank you. Malki Tzedek. How could I forget? Because he was a minor character. That's why we forget. Okay. So this week we're doing Mrs. Lot. Now, I know that at first glance, Mrs. Lot doesn't seem like a minor character. I mean, Lot's not a kind of minor character. He's a major character. And Mrs. Lot is married to Lot. Surely she takes a large role in this whole story, you would think. Except how many times is she actually mentioned? How many times is Mrs. Lot actually mentioned as doing anything? Sure, there's only once. He's only mentioned one time. And we're going to see it. It's only in one single pasuk. It's one of the shortest pasukim in the whole Torah. That's where she's mentioned. We've built up this whole thing in our minds. You all know what I'm talking about. We know exactly where Mrs. Lot is mentioned because we know what happened to her, and it's very sensational. And we're going to evaluate that and ask a few questions on the story. So let's jump in. So Lot has been told by his visitors that Sodom is going to be overturned and everything's going to be destroyed, and he needs to get out of there. And they start to go. He tries to get his sons-in-law to come with him, but they're laughing at him. So he decides he's going to leave just with his two unmarried daughters and his wife. They say to him, be careful. Al tabit acharecha ve'al tamod b'chol ha'kikar ha'hara himaleit penti safeh. Don't look backwards. Don't stand still in this entire area. Get out of here. Just keep going to the mountains and don't stop because you'll get caught. You know, it's like it's cinematic, right? There's a movie going on over here where Lot is running away and there's this volcanic ash coming after him and he's running as fast as he can, except it's in slow motion and the ash is falling and every step that he takes, just a second later, the ash hits it. He says, listen, I don't think I can make it. I'm an old man. He's not so old, but he says, I don't think I can make it. Please just let me stay in Soar. And I'll, you know, it's not such a big deal. And they actually let him. It's quite amazing, by the way. It's something that's overlooked. Rashi points this out, although he doesn't say much about it. Avram debated with God, negotiated, begged to save all of these cities, and Hashem wouldn't save any of them. The answer was no. Lot just asks nicely, and he saves like that. He saves Tsoar, the entire city. The entire city was saved. Amazing. But then what happens? Hashem yatzah la'aretz v'lot ba Tsoar. He makes the Tsoar. V'Hashem himtir al Sodom v'al Amorah gafrit v'esh meit Hashem min ha'shamayim. So this gafrit and esh is coming down. What's gafrit? Anybody want to translate gafrit?
Sulfur.
Sulfur,
brimstone,
sulfur and fire. Gafrit v'esh meit Hashem min ha'shamayim. V'yafoch et ha'arim ha'el v'et kol ha'kikar v'et kol yoshei ha'arim v'tzemach ha'adamah. Everything is destroyed. And then those fateful words, v'tabet ishto me'acharav v'tehi netziv melach. Who wants to translate that pasuk for me? What does that pasuk mean? Give it a go, somebody.
She looked behind him and she became a pillar of salt.
Oh, yafeh. I like the way you translated it. So first you helped us with all the pronouns, okay? So you helped us with me'acharav, right? Which means behind him. Presumably you're talking about Lot. And then you said v'atihitzik, she became a pillar of salt. So here are my questions that I want to ask on this story. Number one, why does she look back? Okay? That's question number one. I'm sure we can all think of a lot of reasons why she looks back, but I think it's interesting to ask this question and see how the Mefarshim deal with it. Second question, what exactly happened to her? You know, there was a movie a few years ago, several years ago, it was a made-for-TV movie about Noah. Not the one that came out a couple of years ago by Darren Aronofsky, the son of my eighth grade chemistry teacher, which was with Russell Crowe, but a different one that was made for, I don't know, I think it was like 15 years ago. I remember watching it on NBC. I think it starred John Voight. And they did something really funny where basically they positioned the story of Sodom as happening before the Mabul, which is kind of amazing that they could do that. And nobody, like no editor jumped in and said, wait a second, guys. Maybe they did it on purpose. I don't know. But what happened was, of course, you know, this, I don't know if this is the basis of our views over here or if this is just the totza'ah. Lot's wife turns around and she, like movie magic, morphs into a pillar of salt, into a pillar, I don't know, amorphous pillar, right? Is that really what happened to her? Is that what we think actually happened? That's question number two. Question number three, why? Why is she, is it a punishment? Why does it happen to her? All she does is look backwards and she turns into a pillar of salt. Apparently, she was meant to be saved. She was good enough, right, to escape from Sodom. And yet just looking backwards made her turn into a pillar of salt. It's quite amazing. What exactly is going on over there? Okay. And then, of course, question number four, which I didn't list over here, which is the question that we always have to ask. What question do we always have to ask, especially when dealing with minor characters? Jeannie, you were there on Shabbos, so you know the answer. You know the question that I'm talking about. Why is the story being told? Why do we need to know about that? Why do we need to know about this? I get it. Sodom is important, but why do we need to know about the part where Lot's wife turns around and turns into a pillar of salt? Okay. You guys want to take, I want to hear your thoughts about these questions. Why does she look back? What happened to her? Why is she punished? Why is the story here? What do you think? Clive K, you're writing on my screen. So that means you have something to say. What do you think, Clive? Come on, guys. Something. Why does she look back? Easy one.
Curiosity killed the cat.
Yafeh. Curiosity killed the cat. She wants to see, right? Wouldn't we all? If there was a volcano going on behind you and you knew you were safe from the volcano, of course you'd look. There are people who chase storms, right? For the sake of science. But, you know, it's interesting. It's fascinating. Disasters, as terrible as they are still, you know, compelling things to watch. Okay. So curiosity. So Sonia says, my wife says because she was told not to. So it's Dafka because she was told not to that she turns around. She says, I'm not going to listen to anybody.
I understood that it was that she was being dragged.
What's that, Jake?
She was being dragged along. It wasn't her effort to do this. And she was really longing to be back there. So the whole thing was her feet were carrying her there, but her heart and her eyes were back there.
She didn't want to go. Very good, Jake. She didn't want to go. She didn't want to go. So she was looking back wistfully. Like that, you know, that hunk of ash, that was my home. I wish I was there. Something like that.
She seems to have some children there also. If only the two daughters went with, then there are definitely other people that were mentioned.
Right. Concern for her family, concern for her friends probably also, right? I mean, wouldn't you? All right, very good. Okay. All right, let's jump in. So first we got to start by naming Mrs. Lot. Okay, obviously the Torah doesn't tell us what her name is. Maybe that's on purpose. The Baal HaTurim tells us, based on the Midrash, it's based on Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, he says, I'll tell you how you know what her name is. You take the word Ishto, you do the Gematria, which I didn't do, and he says, Ishto b'Gematria hi Irit, which the Midrash says that was her name. Her name is Irit. There you go. Ayin Yud, Resh, Yud, Tuf. It's got that Tuf in there, so there's a good chance that he's right. It's also because he's the Baal HaTurim. So there's another good chance that he's right. Let's see. 420... 620, 690. Yeah? Is that the math? 690? And then Ishto, we got, it doesn't look like it's going to be exact. Oh, maybe it's the whole thing. Vatabet Ishto. It's got to be. Let's see. Shin and Tuf is already, wait, that's already 700, no? Uh-oh, we're in trouble here.
I think it must be He Irit.
Ah, He Irit.
You get 16 from there and you probably have the, you know.
So what is that? That's 300 and, no, sorry, that's.
Yeah, 690 and another 16. It'll bring you to 706.
706. Okay, good, good, good. 706. But here we've got a Tuf.
That's no, just Ishto.
Oh, Ishto, just Ishto? Okay, fine. 707. Okay, and the kolel. There we go. Yeah. You made it with the kolel. Okay. Irit with the kolel. He irit with the kolel gets you to Ishto. Okay, very good. So that's her name. Now we've named Mrs. Lot. We can call her Mrs. Lot, or we can call her Irit from now on. So that Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar that he's quoting, so it gives us a little bit of the story. I want to break this down. I guess the breakdown of the shir will be basically just about three approaches into understanding what happened to Mrs. Lot, Irit. And through that, we'll also be seeing a bunch of different themes about why it happened. Okay? So, Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar says, Amar lehem, al tabitu la'achoreichem, sharei yarda shkinato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu lehamtir al stom ve'al amar gafrit ve'esh. Don't look, because Hashem is destroying it. Irit ishto shel Lot, nichmeru rachma al benoteha. Okay, so Jake, you start with you. She had children that were back. Oh no, this wasn't Jake. This was who was it? Mike, Michael. She had daughters that were still married that were there, right? Remember the sons-in-law that laughed at Lot? So they stayed there with their wives. Those are the two daughters of Lot that stayed. He had four daughters: two that were married, two that were engaged, betrothed, whatever. The two that were betrothed came with him. The two that were married stayed behind. So she's looking back at her two daughters. She wants to see, are they coming or not? So you got to feel bad for her, right? She's just looking back to see if her daughters are coming. So Martin, here we go. The Midrash understands Acharav differently. It says, what did she look? She looked behind the Shekhinah. Ra'at acharei ha-Shekhinah. What does that mean? What do you think that means? I'll tell you what I think it means. I can't claim to know for sure. But my sense from the Midrash is that if the Midrash is trying to blame Lot's wife for something, if she's done something wrong, then perhaps what's going on is that, you know, she's feels bad for her daughters, but her daughters stayed there because they wanted to stay there, right? They wanted to remain part of Sodom. And all of Sodom is being punished. They're guilty, right? So by looking backwards and feeling compassion and feeling pain and loss and suffering, as human and as understandable as that is, she's basically questioning the Shekhinah. And that's captured, I think, by the Midrash's language of Ra'at Acharei HaShekhinah. She's looking past the Shekhinah. She's saying, I don't think you're right. Like, I want to see what's going on over there because I think you've done this wrong, Shekhinah. I don't think it's fair. And then because of that, she's punished by turning into a pillar of salt, which was the fate of Sodom. We'll return to this later. But could be what it means. Yeah.
If I might interject here, I've got one grammatical issue with this.
Okay.
This is Vatabet Acharav.
Me Acharav.
Me Acharav. And if you were going to refer to, and if the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says Acharei HaShekhinah, Shekhinah is Nekeva. So it wouldn't be Acharav. If he would say Verata Acharei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that would be different. But he specifically uses the word HaShekhinah.
So my answer to that would be, it says Hashem Himtir Al Sodom. What's the gender for Hashem? Yudke Vavke.
Generally masculine, yes.
Generally masculine, which is what this is talking about, Acharav. The Midrash uses the word Shekhinah because that's just a typical way of describing Hashem, but it doesn't mean that the text has to. This Me'acharav could be talking about this word, Vahashem. That could be the scope. That seems to be how the Midrash is reading it.
Okay.
Here's another answer. The Midrash says, "Vatabet ishtoma acharav, achar shamar lahamalach al tabit acharecha hayta nafsha homa al bnoteha nisharot b'stom." So this is, Midrash is going the same thing, but now it adds on another dimension, which is going to be familiar to everybody. Vatehi nitziv melach lefi shechata b'melach, because she sinned through salt. I say it's familiar because, as we're going to see, Rashi quotes the part of this Midrash. I say part because you'll see that there are a lot of different versions of this Midrash. They all agree, almost all the Midrashim agree, that her turning into a pillar of salt, a Nitziv Melach, is somehow commensurate with something that she did in Sdom that had something to do with salt. Okay? The Fishachat Abba Melach. So what did she do? So this Midrash says, Bota Laila Shebao Melachim Beito Shalot, Alchahi Eitzel Shechenaha, Ba'alila lishol melach. She went to her shchenim to ask for salt. Amrula shchena avalama atzicha melach. Why do you need melach? V'chein yodat shahita chasera melach lilech likach melach mi ba'od yom. If you knew that you didn't have any melach, you should have come during the day. Why do you all of a sudden need it at night? Amrala einanu tzicha melach. Ela shebao lanu orchim. We don't need the melach, but guests have come. Now, the truth is that at first when I read this Medrash, I almost felt bad because it looked like Lot's wife made a mistake. Looks like she did it by accident. She gave away the game. As we know, Sodom doesn't like guests. They believe that traveling guests that come in will just increase and they'll take up their economic power. So they had a ban on guests. You weren't allowed to host guests. So it looked to me like she was doing this by accident. But the truth is, the Midrash says, Ba'alila. Ba'alila means that she was doing it with ill intent. Okay? So basically, she was the one who tipped off the rest of the populace, right? Lot begged the angels to come in so that nobody would see. And then his wife went and told everybody about it. Here's another one that says the same thing. She planned this. This is what she wanted. This was the kind of person that she was. Now, I say Rashi quotes part of it because Rashi has a different version of it. Okay? In these versions, she's going to borrow salt from everybody. Okay? But in Rashi's version, Lot asks his wife to give salt to the guests. Amalo, afamine karaha zeta balan higba makomaze. Here, she's talking to Lot and she's yelling at him and says, it's bad enough that you're trying to bring justice to the city by becoming the shofet. Now you also want to bring hachnasat orchim and chesed. You're going to give melech to them. So it's actually just the words that she uses to yell at Lot and to express her displeasure at the fact that they're hosting guests. Now, I find something extremely interesting about this, which is literarily interesting and touches on a different episode in the parasha. Anybody know what I'm talking about? So Rabbi Tzvi Grumet, he points this out. He says, and actually, let me preface that. He doesn't mention this, but there are a lot of parallels between the story of Lot and a bunch of other stories in Tanakh. Okay? I once gave a shiur based on Rabbi Foreman about all the parallels between the story of Lot and the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, the way that they both are fleeing from destruction. And it's not a mistake, and it's not a coincidence that Chazal say that what did Lot serve his guests?
Matzah,
because it was, and he says, because it was El Pesach, right? So give all shiur on that. This wasn't just a flourish of like, oh, let's make it fun. Let's just throw Pesach in there. They like to throw Pesach everywhere. No, it was the night of Pesach, okay? But there is another story that has even more parallels, and it's even more obvious, and it's almost like I'll say it to you, and then you'll roll your eyes. You'll say, well, of course. Which story am I talking about? And I say parallels because the word usages are the same. There's even a chiastic structure. Okay, though that's a great story over there. The Ramban is a long Ramban over there about comparison to Pilegesh Bagiva. That's a great, great, great answer. I'm talking about even earlier and even simpler. Just doesn't even take much. You don't even have to go very far. You won't even get tired flipping the pages in Tanakh. It's the beginning of Vayera. right? The story, the parsha opens with Avram welcoming guests. It's the same guests, right? And what does Avram do? He serves them food. He asks them to wash their feet. He takes care of them. He begs them not to leave too early. He sits them down. Okay. You'll find that the word usages in both stories are extremely similar. I'll give you a few examples. For example, and this is not surprising, it almost is obvious, but what do they say to Lot? Don't turn around, pentisafe. Have we seen this before, pentisafe? This word tisafe, it's not very common, right? What does it even mean? Have we seen the word before? You remember?
When Avram argues with Hashem about Sodom.
That's right. That's exactly right. When Avram argues with Hashem about Sodom, what words does he use? What does he say to Hashem to accuse of him being unfair? Let me find it. Ha'af tispe v'lo tisa l'makom l'man chamishim ha'tzadikim asher b'kirba. He actually uses it a few times. That's just one of them. Ha'af tispe tzadikim rasha. Will you sweep away the innocent along with the guilty, right? It's not a coincidence that the malachim use the same word. It's like they're quoting Avram, right? But it's not just that. You know, there's a ton of this chiastic structure over here, which leads me to wonder, you know, why does Rashi place Lot's wife as being part of the story of serving the food? What's the answer? Because it's trying to compare Lot's wife to somebody else. Who is it comparing her to?
Sarah.
To Sarah, right? Avram asks Sarah to do exactly that. And she's presumably happy to do it, right? Which she presumably did. It doesn't say anything, but presumably she did so. And it's comparing, this is what Rabbi Grama points out, it's comparing Lot's wife with Sarah, and how she was full of chesed, Sarah, and Lot was not. Now, what's common between all these, they appear to be saying that this Netziv Melech business was a punishment to Lot's wife for something that she had done in the past. Right? That perhaps she had escaped until now, but she really couldn't, she couldn't run away from it because it was really just a part of her. And she was never going to get away from it. And it seems that it was a miraculous occurrence that she turned into a Netziv Melech. It wasn't just something that happened naturally. It was that, oh, she looked back, did what she was supposed to do, boom, Netziv Melech. Transformation, transmogrification into a pillar of salt. Fine. That seems to be common. But there is another way to approach this. And it's not that far-fetched. The Ibn Ezra says, Me'acharav, me'achari lot. Okay, so Martin, Ibn Ezra's on your side. Nitziv, ketam matzeva. It's a strange word, nitziv. It's not Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda mi Berlin. Here it's a nitziv. What is it? Kamo matzeva, like a pillar. Okay, even though nitziv, it should just say matzeva. But okay. Ki nisrefu atzameha begafrit v'hayta im melech. This is simple. Ibn Ezra basically says, all that gafrit, the nesh that was coming down, you know it was in there also? Well, it wasn't in there, but it was caused by all that gafrit va'esh. It took the sand and got heated up. What happens when you heat up sand? What does it turn? Well, I mean, inside of the gafrit and esh, there was also salt. That was what was in there. Ki ken katuv gafrit va'melach, it says in Dvarim, ki ma'apichat Sodom. It says that there was melach in the whole story of Sodom. Gam ze ha'pasuk yoreshim l'tah Torah, gam ken amar ha'melach. Fine. So according to the Ibn Ezra, you don't have to go so far as the NBC made-for-TV movie to say that, oh, boom, she turned it to Melech. No, what happened to her? She paused, she stopped, and in slow motion, Lot kept running, she stopped, and everything behind Lot just exploded into salt. And that's what happened to her. She got covered in salt. Now,
it sounds like as they were walking, they were just one step ahead of everything falling behind them.
It does sound like that.
That's what they were told, don't stand still.
It does sound like that.
One step ahead. And once she stopped,
yeah,
she was no longer one step ahead of it, and that's why she got hit.
Yeah. There are mefarshim, I forget which one, that said that basically Lot was the only one who was really protected, and everybody behind, I think actually we are going to see it, everybody behind him, and this is important because it tells you where he was, everybody behind him turned into, you know, got hit by the gafrit and the esh. but only he was protected and everybody in front of him was protected. Right, so we'll see that in a second. But now I want to take a little bit of a detour. There are two literary stories that I want to look at. One of them is quite famous. The other one, none of you have ever heard. I can almost guarantee it. But it's actually a quote from a story, a short story that I've always loved, and I never had a good opportunity to say it. And then I pointed out to Sonia this week, I said, you know, I was reading it. I won't tell you where. I was just reading it, and I looked and I said, wow, I know why I love this quote so much, because it reminds me of the story of Lot. You'll see it in a few minutes. But first, we'll take a detour to Greece, okay? Famous myth about Orpheus and Eurydice. I actually have a YouTube clip that I want to play for you just to change things up a little bit. Let me find it.
The demonic god.
Okay, so hold on. So let me make sure that I'm sharing my computer sound. Go back for a second.
For the water, he would never.
Can you guys hear that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. So the story of Orpheus and Eurydice is that Orpheus was at a wedding. He was getting married to Eurydice, and she was actually killed by a snake. And she went to Hades. I mean, she went to the underworld, where you go. You know, you go to Gehenna. And Orpheus decides he's going to go after her. And Orpheus is a great musician, and he makes his way into the underworld, and he passes every obstacle by playing music for them, and he entrances everybody. And then he finally reaches the place where Eurydice is, and he begs for her life. He wants to take her back to the world. And this is what happens.
Never be allowed to drink. Even the Furies, the demonic goddesses of vengeance, wept. Hades and Persephone granted Orpheus's plea, but on one condition. As he climbed back out of the underworld, he must not turn around to see if Eurydice was following behind him. If he did, she would return to the land of the dead forever. Orpheus began to climb. With each step, he worried more and more about whether Eurydice was behind him. He heard nothing. Where were her footsteps? Finally, just before he stepped out of the underworld and into the bright light of day, he gave in to temptation. Orpheus tried to return to the underworld, but was refused entry.
Okay. So why do I bring this? Because there are a lot of similarities between these two stories. I found online a lot of scholars tried to compare the stories. The similar theme, this theme of don't look back, right? Obviously, in the story, Lot is not the one who looks back. It's his wife who looks back. And Orpheus and Eurydice, it's Orpheus who looks back, and he's not the one who's punished. It's Eurydice, well, he is punished, but it's Eurydice who doesn't get back into the world. So what is it that causes Orpheus to look back? According to the way that at least this was told. It said, afraid she was no longer there and eager to see her, the lover turned his eyes. And in that instant, she got dropped back. So what is really the thing that makes him look back?
His concern for her welfare.
Why is he concerned?
He hasn't heard. He wants to know that she's behind him.
Because he doesn't know she's really there. You know, he hasn't heard her. He can't see her because he can't see. So he can't help himself. He doesn't believe. He doesn't believe. So he needs to turn around and see. Take a look at the Radak. The Radak says, "Vatabet ishto me'acharav, ishto shaita me'acharelot." So the Radak is saying that his wife was actually behind Lot. He bita achareha. I don't know why he says this. Here you have a gender problem as well. She looked behind her. Ki hayta katnat emuna vebita im nehefcha ha'ir v'im lo. As Clive said, curiosity killed the cat. Right? She looked back because she wasn't sure. Did it really happen? Va'afal pi she'shama azarat ha'malach lilot. She heard the warning. She knew what was supposed to happen, but she didn't really believe. Okay, so the point is that what made her turn around, she didn't really believe. Okay? That's according to the Radak. And it's almost like this lack of emunah is what seals her fate. In order to survive this, you have to believe and not look back, without looking back. It's almost like this leap of faith that Lot is able to do. Right? Because we have to ask, you know, to begin with, why is it that Hashem says not to look back? There could be many reasons, but one possibility is you have to believe. I want you to trust me that this is what's happening behind you. And Lot's wife is not able to do that. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman actually says a similar thing. He says, Lo he'emina ishazu, She wants to see it proven. Okay, so then he has another option, but this is his first opinion. Now, there's something else I wanted to say, and that's the Bechor Shor, and that's going to lead us to our next quote from a story. So the Bechor Shor, another major Rishon, so he says, there's another thing that was going on. So this is what Jake was saying before. She wasn't in a hurry to go. She didn't want to leave. We already know, actually, that Lot didn't want to go either. How do we know that Lot didn't want to go? Martin, you know this. How do we know that Lot didn't want to go? The Shalshelet, right? The first Shalshelet in Chumash. Wait, Mama. What was that, Gina?
From the Tamim.
Yeah. The Shalshelet, which there are four Shalshelot in the Torah. We don't have time to go through all of them. But one way of understanding is that they all indicate vacillation, a person who's not sure what he wants to do, someone who's struggling. And so over here, Lot is not sure that he wants to go. But here, his wife really isn't sure. Even when she sees, even though the rain of fire has started, she's not sure. So that's what it is. Me'acharav vid bikata ha'anan hanifshat v'nifras alayim gafritu meinu alech. She paused, and she was enveloped, and then she became a pillar of salt because she was standing there, and it came on top of her. They were all pillars of salt, but she was the one. She became also a pillar of salt. Now, why do I mention this? So. There's the sense that she's unwilling to go.
Can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
They weren't all pillars of salt because we know that Lot's two daughters got out of there alive.
No, I meant everybody that was still in stone. They were all pillars. Like, everybody was covered in Gafrit Va'esh and Melach. That's what I meant. So, I mean, she wasn't the only pillar of salt. Everybody there was a pillar of salt. Everybody who stayed behind. Now, what strikes me as interesting about this is the sense that she's unready. She's unready to go because she's holding on to the past. There's a story written by Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury is my favorite author. He writes a lot of short stories. He wrote one long story called Fahrenheit 451 that maybe you've heard of. And he wrote a book of short stories. It's called The Martian Chronicles, which is basically like this fake history. It started in the 1960s of how humans, he was a big fan of space travel, of how humans eventually colonized Mars. And in the story, which is a collection of short stories, they go to Mars and then they end up coming back to Earth because there's this big nuclear war on Earth that's happening and they feel obligated to come back. Except in the end of the story, in the end of the book, the last story is called The Million Year Picnic. And it talks about this person who is still on Mars with his family. He's one of the only families that's still there. And he heard on the radio, basically, that the entire Earth has been destroyed. All the nuclear bombs have gone off. The entire Earth has been destroyed. But he hasn't told his kids yet. He told his wife. So he decides he needs to find a way to break it to them. So they go on a picnic, knowing that basically they're one of the last human families left in the universe. And they're going and they're traveling all over Mars. And as they're going, there's this beautiful scene where it's only he and his wife who know. And he's sitting in the front of the car and he's looking, he's sitting in the back of the car and his wife is sitting in the front. And she kept looking ahead to see what was there. Right? She knows that basically, their old life is over. Their whole existence is over. She kept looking ahead to see what was there. And not being able to see it clearly enough, she looked backward towards her husband. And through his eyes, reflected then, she saw what was ahead. And since he added part of himself to this reflection, a determined firmness, her face relaxed and she accepted it. And she turned back, knowing suddenly what to look for. I love this description. It's basically, the wife, she's looking forward and she cannot imagine what's ahead of them. Their whole life is over and she doesn't know how she's going to continue. So she looks back and she sees in the eyes of her husband, she sees the future, right? She sees what's in front of them, except he knows what's coming, right? He has a determined firmness. He's resolute that they're going to make something of the universe, of the rest of the universe for human beings. And because she sees the world reflected through his eyes, she's able to see that world along with him. And I just get this feeling like Lot's wife was looking for the same thing. She looked backwards and she's looking through Lot's eyes, but she doesn't see the future, either because Lot doesn't see the future either. We know what happens afterwards with his daughters, or because she can't see. And there's this sense that she needs to go back because it's all she's ever known. She cannot imagine a world without stone, without her family, without her friends, without her whole community, without that way of life. And she can't continue. And so she gets stuck. What is salt? What does salt do? What do we use it for?
Preservative.
It's a preservative. It keeps things the way they are. Lot's wife can't move on. She can't look forward. And perhaps that's the meaning, ultimately, the inner meaning, the deeper meaning of why she becomes a pillar of salt. Okay, I see it's very late. Just want to quickly cover a couple more ideas. There's one more idea of pshat that we have to say. What we've seen so far, according to these Rishonim, is that there's nothing supernatural about what happened to Lot's wife, any more than the destruction of stone. She simply was enveloped by the same thing that destroyed stone. Rabbeinu Bechaye quotes the Ibn Ezra, and the Abarbanel also quotes the Ralbag as saying something quite astonishing, and saying that we misunderstood the pronoun here completely. Or not the pronoun, actually, the inner pronoun to this verb. V'atabet ishto me'acharav, v'atehi netziv melach. Why are we so sure that the word v'atehi refers to Lot's wife? The Ibn Ezra apparently says it doesn't refer to Lot's wife. It refers to Haaretz. And the Rabbah goes with this as well. He says, Eino chozer v'tehi netziv melech li'ishto shalot, kimel sdom shnesta netziv melech. Lot's wife didn't turn into a pillar of salt. And she didn't get covered and enveloped by the salt either. She looked behind and she saw what happened. She saw that the whole city had become salt. That's what she saw. Which is, of course, what she saw. We're influenced by Rashi, and it's obvious that, of course, Vatehi refers to Lot's wife. Now, what happened to Lot's wife? Well, she doesn't show up again, right? And we know that when Lot gets to Tzoar, when he leaves Tzoar, actually, and he goes to the mountains, he's there alone, presumably alone, with his daughters, because they're the only ones mentioned, right? So the Rabbah concedes and says, Ishto shalot meta me'atzma. Kinyan abanot yore alav. The fact that the whole story happened only makes sense if Lot's wife is not around. I'll be honest. I don't know why not. It could have happened even with Lot's wife there. I'm just trying to imagine a history where Lot's wife actually lives. I think it's conceivable. If you go all the way. She's not mentioned, but maybe.
But a few psukim before, we were explicitly told that anyone who looks back will be punished.
That's true. But if the Ralbag, it wouldn't be the first time Hashem promised to punish somebody and didn't. Told them hands off and then they didn't. But either way, according to the Ralbag, she at least wasn't punished immediately. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to tell. The Rabbanel is not having it, by the way. Nobody agrees with the Ralbag or with the Ibn Ezra. That's not the mainstream approach. But he actually calls it a dat kozev. Okay? But it does bring us to the last point that I wanted to make. There are more points to make, but I think we're going to suffice with this. Another answer to the question of why did this happen to Lot's wife? And this is something that the Rabbanel says and is echoed very forcefully by the Kli Yakar, unsurprisingly. The Rabbanel says, why does she look back? So she says, she looked behind Lot. Okay. Lot was being told, don't look back. Don't worry about the life that you're leaving behind and all the money that you're leaving behind. But she couldn't handle it. She had to look back. Aval hibita me'acharav, klomar she'itaska lahatzil hatzon. It's not just that she looked back. She was, while he was running, she was trying to grab everything that she could. She wasn't happy with just the photo albums. She was trying to grab all the jewelry and all the tzon and everything that she had. She was actually in the ear while it was happening because she couldn't give up everything. And the Kliyakar, unsurprisingly, the Kliyakar hates money. If you ever learn a Kliyakar, just keep this in mind. He hates money. And he unsurprisingly picks up on this part. He says, they couldn't stand the fact that they weren't able to save their money. It should have said she looked behind herself. Why does it say me'acharav? And the Kliyakar says, I'm not happy with Achazal's explanation that she turned into melach because she wouldn't give melach to the guests. Because why now? Ella lefishach shav nitzdara al ibud mamona. She was worried about what's going to happen after he's gone. Me'acharav. Once Lot's gone, I've got nothing because my ketubah is worthless. She'll have no inheritance. He literally uses the word ketubah. Her ketubah is worthless. It's not talking about that it was terrible. It's just that this is the reality. This is the way she was. Not bad enough that she didn't give tzedakah. That was just a symptom of her attitude. She wasn't willing to give tzedakah. This is the Gemara in Ksubas that talks about how the daughter of, I forget which one of the three great wealthy people in Yerushalayim who used to take care of everybody. And
Magnak Simon Ben Gurion, maybe.
Yeah, one of them, the one whose daughter, survived. Daughter of Simon Ben Gurion. Yeah, and she didn't have melach and the whole thing. And the Gemara talks about how melach, its job is to preserve, as we were saying before. But in this case, the Gemara uses it in a good way, that giving tzedakah preserves your money. It preserves your wealth. And so he says, ki mitzvah, she wouldn't do anything. Because she sinned through salt, and therefore she was punished with salt. But the salt here is because of the lack of giving tzedakah. All right, there's actually a bunch more to say. If you want to hear more, maybe I'll get to it in Laskov, and you can come there. Although there's a good chance I won't get to it there either. I'll have to cut down. But Yishar Koch and a Shabbat Shalom to everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Shabbat Shalom.